Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Big Interview Q&A Show. I'm Martin Gregg, and with me today are Graeme Hunter, host of The Big Interview, and our guest for these shows, La Liga TV's Pete Jensen. We have questions, as always, from our socios who support this podcast at patreon.com/Graeme Hunter and from our wonderful sponsors at Bet365. So, lads, we're going to start with a couple of questions on Barca. First up is from our sponsors at Bet365 who ask, with Juan Laporta returning as president, what does this mean for Barcelona's and Lionel Messi's future? And the second one is related to that from socio Jake Garlick, who says, a few months ago, it looked like there was no way Koeman would be Barcelona coach next season. Now it looks almost certain he will be staying. Is he their man for the foreseeable future? Or are they looking to replace him as soon as there is a slight downturn? So that's kind of two related questions, return of Laporta and the future of Messi and Koeman. Graeme, I don't know if you want to maybe pick this one up because you were quite close to the Laporta story. First time around, if I recall rightly, 2003 was probably not long after you moved to Spain and then enter Laporta, and it all got a bit interesting after that.
Yeah, I'll take a small bite out of the apple here and then pass to Pete because He's spoken directly to Joan Laporta more recently than me, but you are right that before we get to Bet365 or Jake's questions, we are talking about a really mercurial, fascinating figure who's given all of us, both the listeners to this, given that you published the first book that I wrote, and Pete, given that for all of us, life here in Spain has gifted us football that I think in most cases we couldn't really have imagined in terms of the quality, or in the first time around, we'll see what this brings, the access. One of the things that I really like that nobody ever talks about from Joan Laporta's first reign was that an edict was passed down that players had to speak more regularly. There were more press conferences, there were more mixed zones. Obviously, the players then had to embrace the idea themselves. But way back then in 2003, the idea was that as part of the refresh button that Laporta was pressing, football, finance, profile, competitive teeth, there was a general idea that there should be more press conferences. And at that stage, there was, if not daily, it was very close to daily, players sitting down and talking in the press conference room. It was easier to get to the players, and there was a mix zone introduced. And that helped cover that era with more... Well, you paid to with more colours in your palette. And people tell you, too, that you got to know the main protagonists much more, whether it was Ingla and Ferran Soriano, or Beginner's Time was a little bit more tricksy to get close to. But the players too, you simply were given more tools to do your descriptive job. And I think that was a great privilege because clearly you'd have been writing the same thing about the football anyway. But you obviously do it with much more educated views if you get in and around them. And I'm right to say, Pete, that relatively recently, before he retook the presidency, you had a little bit of access to Laporta, which I think brings hauls the whole thing up to date in terms of answering that. I've got opinions on Jake's question 365. I'll come back in bits and pieces of those, but you've got a much more educated view on the newer version of John Laporta.
Yeah, I think that the new version is pretty much the same as the old version. Just a few more grey hairs. I mean, as you say, he likes to be close to people, whether that's because he wants to give them a hug or put them in a headlock if he's not happy with them. But he does like that closeness. And as you say, that then transfers in terms of closeness between the media and the fans and the players, which obviously we welcome. I felt a bit sorry for Victor Font. I thought in order to win, he needed things to go worse than they were going. He needed Koeman to be a bit of a disaster and everyone to be thinking, you know, we really do need to get Xavi on board now. He needed Messi to keep the kind of staring at the ground and not be happy and not really want to be playing at Barcelona, for people to think, well, it doesn't matter if he stays, best if he goes. And obviously those two things didn't happen. Everyone wants Messi to stay and everyone seems pretty convinced by Koeman, and I think that's why Laporta won with the landslide that he did, and Xavi's time will come, and that might mean Victor Font's time comes as well. He's got that natural ability to lead Laporta. He's got that aura, he's got that charisma. The inauguration ceremony, I'm not sure that's the correct word for it, but it certainly seemed like an inauguration ceremony. You know, he spoke for about half an hour without any notes, winked to Messi, and who was watching from the stands, and people seem to think that's significant, the fact that Messi turned up for this. The players are happy when there's someone in charge. The players are happy when, you know, if the club's falling apart, the questions about the club falling apart are not put to them. They're put to the man at the top. And Laporta will stick his chest out and lift his chin up, and he'll take the compliments, and he'll take the brickbats as well if things start not to go so well. And in terms of Koeman, is he the right man to take the club forward? I think he's done incredibly this season. I really do. I think he's come up with a system that has brought the best out of seven or eight of the players. Suddenly Dembele looks like a centre forward, stretching teams and making space for Messi and Griezmann behind him. That's bringing the best out of those two. Mingesa is an incredible discovery. Destin Alba, love playing as wing-backs. Pedri's a gift. I mean, Koeman doesn't take credit for Pedri. Pedri's, you know, just fallen out of the sky, manna from heaven. He's got De Jong playing well. He's even got De Jong now operating as a sweeper at the back in that back three. So the team are playing really well. I did the game at the weekend against Real Sociedad, and it was like watching Guardiola's Barca. I mean, the last goal, they pretty much got nine players in the box, and you're just wondering which one of them is going to eventually put it in the back of the net. So everything is hunky dory, and it's luck in a way, isn't it? Laporta comes in just at this moment, but you know, you're lucky so many times that in the end you have to draw the conclusion that it's about more than that. And I do think he has had an effect on the morale of the whole club.
Just tell people what I think is true, Pete. It's often, authors often talk about he, she had a twinkle in their eye. And Laporta, without any pejorative meaning to this, because that's a separate conversation, he is a lovable rogue. There is an element of the rogue about him. And I don't mean that. I don't mean that in a crooked way. But he's an outright. I mean, but again, you could use the word rascal. And when you're around him, he'll draw you in. I think there's definitely that wee twinkle in his eye. He knows that you both know you're playing a wee game if you're interviewing him. But there's definitely, when his face lights up in that little roguish smile, I think a lot of people will forgive him a lot of things. I think that's one of the ways in which he's risen in life. And wasn't it striking the degree to which any player who'd either worked for him before, or in Alba's case, who hadn't but had heard all the tales, the push from inside the squad was like, yeah, Laporta. They kind of went, Laporta and everything will be fine, which is not true, because they've got 1.1 billion debts. There are still things to correct in terms of buying and selling all around them. It's a new board. But there was that feeling of hand it to Juan and it'll be fine, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's you sit down with him for 5 minutes and you think, I like this guy. I really like this guy. Right from the moment that he told us to whip our masks off, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, because everyone was, you know, we were safely distanced. But I think behind that glint in the eye and behind that smile, there's someone who gets things done. And another reason why I think this is a good moment for him to come back is what he was very good at in his first time in charge was not just bringing in the right people, and obviously that was down to Chicky Biggerstein, but also getting rid of people that shouldn't be at the club. Because no matter how good the sporting director is, and Chicky did a great job, mistakes are still made. And as it turned out, Chigrinsky was a mistake and Zlatan was a mistake. They were gone after one season. And that capacity, that ability to get rid of players that have been errors in the transfer market, not because they're not good players, but just because they're the wrong players at the wrong time, the ability to get rid of them, they need that now. You know, they need someone to shift out Philippe Coutinho, for example, and probably Pjanic as well, just to name two. He's well connected. There's no one he doesn't know in football. And he's a football man, you know, and you know, the first requisite for a president, I think, is that he understands the game, and Laporte understands the game. You know, you can imagine him in the six sides, you know, playing up the top and knocking centre backs off their feet and holding the ball up for other players. He's a football man, and what is he, 57, 58? So it's not that he's, you know, it's not that he's over the hill for the job. He was a very young man when he took it in 2003. So I think it ended up being the right choice.
I had certain doubts, Martin, about 365 Jake, because, you know, there were hideous stains on the CV when he took over, particularly when it got too heady for him, when the cocktail of fame and success and power got too heady for him, and he made some seriously bad choices. Mostly about how he acted and what his persona became, rather than choices on behalf of the club. And he lost a lot of allies. And the refrain that I kept using, thinking about too, as this election campaign ran, I'm glad Pete mentioned Victor Font, because I thought all his ideas were good, but not necessarily in the right order, because you saw Jordi Cruyff being on his team and then off his team. You saw Xavi being associated with him powerfully and speaking to that, and then kind of not speaking out in the campaign. And you could go on and on about the way in which Victor Font got outdone politically. You know, there was a lot of knuckle duster stuff went on, and Victor Font lost every round, which might mark him down as somebody who shouldn't be president. But when Laporta came to power the first time, he was surrounded by such talent. If you think that his guru was still alive there, the day before recording this was the fifth anniversary of Johan Cruyff dying, and Cruyff was by Laporta's side in every thought, every decision, and that governed the idea that Biggerstein was associated with the project right from day one, who helped choose Hiddink and Koeman originally, neither of whom they could afford to buy the buyout clauses for. Otherwise, Koeman would have been manager way back in 2003. Then they certainly went on Rijkaard, which is Biggerstein's choice. But around in two, if you think about it, as much as I think of him as a reptile now, Sandro Rosé was a mover and a shaker and a fixer, and he fixed Ronaldinho. It wasn't Juan Laporta. And Ferran Soriano utterly, utterly changed the financial profile of the club, completely changed its systems, how they made money, where they didn't spend money. But also, it was Ferran Soriano who's behind the much-lauded UNICEF decision to pay €1 million to have UNICEF on the shirt, which added to the rolling ball of affection from around the world. Didn't win them points or matches. But if you look at the total snowball effect of that first time, every other piece of snow had gone, and Laporta was rolling down the hill on his own. What's remarkable, I think, is that he looks as if he's able to do the same thing twice, and not just win the election, but to regenerate energy and attention and conviction in people around him, in people in the media, in enemies across La Liga, and amongst the squad. So there's a threat that the good times for him and for Barcelona are back. I think Jake asked, is Koeman is his jacket on a shaky nail? Koeman has done exactly what Pete described, which is an extraordinary job, and should undoubtedly be rewarded with the second season. And the challenge then lies, I think it's twofold. Ronald Koeman, I think, has rarely in his career, perhaps with the exception of the first season at Benfica, the time when he had a really young, talented Ajax side, he has rarely been so attentive to detail, attentive to how he handles people on a daily basis. He, during Rijkaard's reign, when Rijkaard was struggling, Koeman was desperate to take over back then. And I found it a little bit unseemly the way in which he had splash interviews in Mundo Deportivo back in the mid-season of 2003-2004. He wanted to take over then. He wanted, now, once his claws had run down at Ajax, where he was coaching and he became affordable and Barcelona's finances were better, he was ready to jump into those shoes. And it felt a little bit, did feel unseemly back then. But when you talk about a dream job, Koeman has lusted after this job for what's now nearly 20 years. And he was becoming anachronistic, I think, in if you look at some of his previous jobs. And he has rejuvenated himself. He's paid attention. He's pared everything down. It's been, not only by Pete's description, an extraordinary job of work, given what you could judge on the football pitch and on the training pitch. It's been extraordinary the way that he's changed himself and focused. And has he got that same focus in year two is a question. And will he be given better herramientos? Will he be given better equipment with which to challenge properly? Because there are three or four big upgrades needed in the team in order to capitalise on what we saw in Paris, where they went toe-to-toe with a pretty good side, one which had devastated them 3 weeks before, and they should have won by two or three clear goals. There are things still to add. So to Jake, I think, Jake, no question, he starts the second season, and I don't think that Laporta is one of those who's like, well, mentally, I'm giving this guy tolerance, but at the first sign of trouble, he's out. I don't think that's the case at all. I also don't think that if Xavi's the replacement for Koeman, wherever that time comes, Xavi's a guy who wants to take over mid-season. So unless something absolutely extraordinary happens, I think Koeman is in charge until summer 2022. After that, it's a long way away. Let's judge then. And, you know, Bet365 asked about Messi, and I've got no doubt, again, now the same sort of terms apply. Unless something extraordinary happens, which would mean them screwing up the financial offer to Messi, my view is that it's some time now that Leo Messi has decided that the risk and the challenges of moving to Paris Saint-Germain or Manchester City are risks and challenges that he no longer needs to confront. I'm not saying it's set in stone that he's staying, but I think that the pendulum has swung dramatically from hard to see him staying to now quite hard to see him leaving.
Yeah, it's interesting going back to the start of his last reign, Laporta, the major, I guess, PR coup, but also obviously footballing coup was Ronaldinho's arrival. And it seems like the single biggest thing that would match that this time is the retention of Messi. And it's really interesting, you know, Pete, you were saying about Messi turning up for the inauguration or whatever it was. I guess it comes back to this thing, if the Messi part of the jigsaw works, then FC Barcelona work. Is that overstating it, do you think, or is that...
No, I don't think it is. And I think, I mean, what has he got now? 23 goals this season, top scorer in the league again. And I also think we're entering a period in football where we're going to see more and more players in their mid to even late 30s still playing at an extremely high level. I think this is the consequences of obviously sports science having changed and players being able to look after themselves so much better than they have been in the past. And, you know, Modric was a sensational a couple of weeks back, or was it last week, in the Champions League, and he's 35 now. So the fact that Messi's 33, you know, if the team around him is right, and he's got the right players playing around him, then there's no reason why Messi can't play for two or three more years if he wants to. So I absolutely think that they're right to make that the priority. That and if Messi, I mean, that's why Barca now, are they favourites to win the league? Well, they've got Messi, so maybe they are, despite Atleti's 4-point advantage.
Okay, thanks for that, guys. It's time for a break. We'll be back in a moment with a few more questions to complete part one of this month's Q&A.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's Amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, and we're back with a question from Socio Richard Cosmala, who says, in your opinion, what has been the reason for the dramatic change in form at Betis? He says, I've got to be honest, I thought Pellegrini was in borrowed time there and maybe with fans in, he would have been disposed of. So just to add to that, Betis have won 5 out of the last 6 games and are 6th in La Liga at the moment. Pete, maybe you can take this on for us. How do you account for the renaissance of Betis?
I think that's absolutely right, by the way. With fans in the stadium, he probably still wouldn't be there, Manuel Pellegrini. But he's done an excellent job. He didn't get what he wanted at the start of the season. He wanted central defensive reinforcements and beyond victory, so I think I came on a free. That didn't happen. They got a new goalkeeper, but Claudio Bravo has not been able to play too many games. But he's managed to cobble together a decent partnership between Victor Reese and Mandy. I think that's the foundation for the run that they've been on. Guido gives them solidity in midfield. He's got the best out of Sergio Canales, who has returned to the team, has totally coincided with this tremendous run that they've been on. And he kept faith in Fekir. I mean, Fekir is so talented, but you know, you could count the goals and assists, you know, in the first part of the season on the fingers of one foot. I mean, he wasn't providing end product, but Pellegrini stuck with him, and I'm sure that lots of people listening to this will have seen the goal that Fekir scored at the weekend, and it, you know, it's possibly goal of the season. And the panda as well, Borja Iglesias up top. So the spine of the team now, with Borja and Fekir behind him, and Guido and Canales behind him, and the two centre backs, as I say, Mandy and Victor Reith. And we shouldn't forget the full backs. Miranda's come in. Apparently, he was exceptional last night for Spain's under 21s. He's been a good signing. And Emerson Royal with G's has been superb as well. So they may lose him to Barcelona at the end of the season. It's a strange sort of setup that they seem to half own him, but Barcelona have the kind of the final word on what happens to him next. But he's been sensational as well. They've now got a great chance of finishing in European place, when I think in the first half of the season, Pellegrini was resigned to it being a relegation battle.
Supercos knows, because as Pete said, you know, Richard was pointing out the fact that Pellegrini wouldn't have been given time and patience. And what I'd like to add to what Pete says is that, you know, Pellegrini's had a little bit of fortune, and these are harsh words, and I suppose they're typical of me because I do tend to be, you know, studs up to food, but Bartra can't defend. And Bartra's kind of in love with the playing style, which he's never been good enough for, which is racing forward with the ball at his feet from the back, not playing out from the back, but he loves to go for a saunter forward. He came through Barca with Gerard Piqué, and Piqué really, to be quite honest with you, treated him like a juvenile apprentice and never really had much time for him as a footballer. And Bartra, I think, looked up to that brand of football, wanted to emulate Piqué, and hasn't got it. And as he's got older and a little bit more, in my book, complacent, his actual ability to defend has become pretty Frank Spencer, pretty haphazard. And I'm really sorry for him that he's missed so many months with injury, but it's been an absolute godsend for the Chilean coach, not having to worry about, because the wage scheme at Betis is unbelievable. The amount of money that players who at any other club would be earning 50% what they're earning. The wage structure, the way that deals were negotiated at Betis is horrendous. It's a millstone around their neck. And therefore, at that club, if Bartra's fit and not playing and being paid what he's paid, and he's only one of about five fit players who are on outrageous, outrageous money that is crippling the club, there comes a lot of pressure on you to play him. We've got this guy, he's a sort of face of the club. Since we bought him, he's on X much a week and he's on the bench. So the way in which the defence has changed is absolutely essential. And I'll say something similar, but nonetheless a little bit more tolerant about Moreno, because the current fad for converting wingers to wing-backs or defenders can yield extraordinary results. But Moreno is still somebody who is always the guy on the scene when there's been a goal conceded. You look at Moreno either having lost the ball high or having been badly positioned or being the guy who plays the striker on by half a metre. And he's a very talented footballer and he's extremely good high up the pitch. There's no question about his pace or his quite tricksy with the ball. And his use of the ball is not bad at all when he's high up the pitch. And he just isn't, he just should not be considered a wing-back or a full-back. And therefore, the bravery of adjusting that and more playing Miranda has been useful for Betis' coach. And Pellegrini is a guy who constructs a playing system in people's minds on the training pitch. He's been shown over and over again that whatever you don't find inspiring about him when he speaks in public, that's generally not what players think about him when he's teaching them day in, day out. So Supercos made the point that, and I think it was a cultural point, and Pete and I both sort of laughed a little bit, Pete echoed the point that with the ultra-demanding crowd and media down there, the board might not have given him time. So we're all smiling that, you know, the pandemic and the lack of crowd has stopped him from being sacked, but what has allowed him to do is teach. He is one of those coaches, not one of the ones who are demagogues and say like, this way or the highway and I'm the boss and Sergeant Majory. He's one who's definitely got firmness, but he's a persuader and he's an educator and he's somebody who shows people why they're not doing what he wants them to do and what the benefits of doing it his way will be. So whether he's super elite or not, across his career, you can see teams that get constructed, and not simply by signing better players. He genuinely is one of those coaches who's an educator and a teacher. He's had time to do that at Betis, and we're seeing the benefits. And Pete named a section of players, and I think it's true almost across the team. Most of the team are now playing at 7.5 or 8 out of 10 of their very best. One or two of them are playing at 9 out of 10 of their very best. And that comes partly from personal engagement and I want to do X with my life. But the other part is what you feel like when you're being shown how to play in my system day in, day out at training. And that's the absolute central key fact, I think.
And Richard, talking about would he have survived with fans in the stadium, at the time when they weren't doing well, Eduardo, the Celta coach, Coudet, had just come in, and he was doing well at Celta, fantastically well. And Betis supporters were, you know, that was the reaction. Why can't we find one of these up-and-coming coaches who's cutting his teeth in South America and doing brilliantly? Why are we paying? Because Pellegrini's being very well paid. Why are we going back to someone who, you know, was great at Malaga and Villarreal, but that was a long time ago? So I absolutely agree that, you know, the pressure would have been on and they probably would have caved in.
OK, let's finish part one of this month's Q&A with a question from Socio Will McLeod. Will says, I haven't given up hope yet, but it looks like my favourite Spanish team's time in the top flight might be coming to an end for now. Why are Eibar having a more difficult season and can they beat the drop?
I think Mendilibar's worried. In fact, I know Mendilibar's worried. How do you get out of trouble down at the bottom? You've got players who will create and score goals for you, and that is Eibar's big problem. They've got two players who can do it. They've got Brian Gil, who's obviously been called up to the Spain squad. and they've got Kike Garcia, who helped save them last season, was tremendous in the last 10 games last season. But there's not a lot beyond that. Charles left, I think it was in the summer, might have been before then, so they don't have a kind of second striker who sort of weighs in with 12 goals. They have real problems scoring goals. They've suffered because of no fans, because Iparua was such a difficult place for teams to go. So it's going to be difficult. Can they save themselves? Well, if they're the three worst teams, and obviously they stay up, and at the moment Alaves look absolutely shocking. It's been a disaster. Abelardo's return, he's fallen out with the one guy who could probably got them out of trouble, Lucas Perez, which is not necessarily his fault, by the way. I don't know what's happened there, but Lucas Perez is not in the team, so I think Alaves are probably going to go. And then there are three more candidates: the Huesca, who are still bottom and probably playing better than four or five teams above them, but they are bottom. He's got a tough job on his hand to turn that around. Pacheta, Elche are down there as well, and I still think Cadiz might drop into it. So other teams may end up being worse, but it's a really tough season for Mendilibar. He works a miracle every year, but if he does it this year, then, you know, it will be something special, because every year the fewer resources to work with, and I'm on the same page there in terms of hoping that they do it, because I like them as a club and I like him as a manager.
I think by definition you all the things that we've admired about the literal miracle that Eibar have produced, because I guess most people that are involved in this show know already, but a lot of people around Europe don't understand exactly how tiny a community Eibar is. It's a little bit isolated. Their resources should not, however clever the people are around the club, their resources shouldn't permit them to have attained top division status and then maintained it. It's genuinely extraordinary that they've been able to do it time and again. And tip over, what was the... One of the apogee moments was when they absolutely pumped Real Madrid, I think 3-0, when poor old Odriozola was at full back and they had Cucurella terrorising him, something that he will probably lose sleep over all his life. And from that day to this, the way in which Eibar have been able to do little deals and get loan players has diminished to the point whereby Brian Hill is not only an absolute standout, he's a little beacon of light showing where the rest of the team has been. What we have seen at Eibar, whereby part of the miracle is that everything always functioned. The Mendilibar is utterly committed, completely committed and brilliantly articulate about, I have always played this way and I will play high up the pitch. I'll press. There'll be a big gap between the goalkeeper and the back line because that's the way I want to understand my life. My football will reflect me. It will be front foot. It will be aggressive. We'll try and press and win the ball. We'll try and harass players up. And frankly, they made this decision some years ago, but it wasn't true of them when they came up. They've now got a beautiful pitch. Previously, it was like playing on the Somme, and big clubs in the sort of 3-4 months in the middle of the season didn't like going up there. The stadium was never, you know, cavernous and threatening in that way, but it was tight and small. When it was full, as Pete say, every single game was like one of those January FA Cup matches where a big dog has gone away to a little, you know, a rooster biter, and we're going to make your afternoon hell. It's not like that anymore. They haven't had the best year in terms of squad building compared to other years. It's been known for a little while that their extraordinary keeper, without him this season, they'd already be relegated, is leaving and going to Sevilla. But overall, what I would say is that at the moment, they don't look like they've got the goal resources to stay up. But overall, what's happened is that, not quite a perfect storm, that would be too dramatic to say, but several things have gone wrong at the same time that a bigger club might be able to cope with, but Eibar have found very difficult to cope with. And at the end of last season, when they were also in relegation trouble and fought their way out of it in that 11-game sprint towards the end of the season after the lockdown in Spain, there were 4 or 5 players out of contract. And the big question was, given that Eibar were in relegation difficulty and given that each of them were going to be leaving, would they kind of go half-heartedly at it because they didn't want to get injured and screw themselves for a summer move? And they didn't. They stood back-to-back and absolutely fought like dogs to stay up. And Mendilibar was out of contract and stayed on. And there was a discussion in the summer about, have we reached an actual break point? Should we stay on? Does this project go on with the club like it is, with Mendilibar like it is? And they said yes. And the same discussion was happening between Ángel Torres and Bordalás at Getafe. And they went, yeah, no, we'll just continue. We'll go on. But in each case, between the president, the board, and the coach, there wasn't disharmony, but there was a, have we reached the end of what's a good run? Have we come to the point where it's actually going to be healthy for everybody to have a change? And in both clubs, they said no. And in both clubs, it looks as if they've just gone a little bit past their freshest in terms of decision-making ideas, in terms of the players going, this guy again, this struggle again. And I don't think it's a coincidence that after the pandemic, the lockdown, the short pre-season, both Getafe and Eibar, both of whom like to play aggressive, high-energy, press, aggress, that they found their motors a little bit short. And obviously that is something that most clubs around Europe have to deal with. Bigger academies, bigger youth systems, bigger budgeted clubs with the winter transfer market have been able to box a little bit more cleverly. There are a lot of things wrong with Getafe, but I think the both of them are linked, both in terms of where they are on the table right now, their iconic, demanding managers, and the style of play. And I think if you agglomerate both of those, I think the mad situation that we're all in, plus that, geez, when is the end of our relationship? When is it not? Those things come together, and it's been a little bit about the sad state that Eibar are in right now.
Okay, that's it for the first part of this month's Q&A. We'll be back tomorrow with more from Pete and Graham. Thanks to the socios who sent questions in, and thank you to you for listening. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.